On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the news this week, half-step surprises and a song. New York's Mayor Bloomberg left the GOP and a hint of ambiguity about his presidential plans.
I'm not running for president, and I'm going to be mayor for the next 925 days. But there's a reason why my picture was there. They thought that I would be a credible candidate. They must think that I'm doing a decent job.
An energy bill clears the Senate. Environmentalists aren't satisfied. Neither are oil boosters like Louisiana Senator David Vitter.
I think it's a horribly imbalanced bill that does very little on the domestic production side.
And Hillary Clinton's campaign has a new theme song from Canada's Celine Dion. Let's jump straight to our crew today. Joining me from Washington is Jake Tapper, senior national correspondent for ABC News. He's also senior political correspondent for the 2008 election. Delighted to have him with us. Jake, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, it's great. Thanks for having me.
With us from New York is E.J. Kessler, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. E.J., thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Jake, and EJ.
I want to go straight to the energy bill. Just came in last night. Here's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid saying it's not perfect, but it shows the Senate can work together.
There are still things with this bill that I don't particularly like. There are things that my colleagues on the other side of the aisle don't like. But we have got to start legislating. And I really do say, I think this could be the beginning of our being able to legislate.
Jake Tapper, you're watching the policy and the politics here. What do you make of what the Senate has put out? Still has to go to the House, still has to go to the President, but here's the framework they're going to be working on.
Well, the most interesting thing I find is obviously the increase in fuel efficiency standards for automobiles, which has been a long time coming. What I wonder is the Michigan legislators who represent the auto industry and have tried to block this for years and have successfully done so, in the Senate, Levin and Stabenow, the two senators from Michigan, they both voted against this energy bill. But in the House, John Dingell, who is one of the old bulls of the House and one of the most powerful people in this country, I just wonder if how much he's going to block this when this thing does go to the House, because he is more powerful as a Michigan legislator in the House than Levin is in the Senate. And I wonder if this thing is going to survive the House.
E.J. Kessler, Eve, what do you see here? It's already it's an increase in mileage that will be required of cars in this country. Detroit fought it tooth and nail, but it's already less than environmentalists want. Do you see this, the politics pushing this through the House or gumming it up in the House?
Well, I see a real challenge for Nancy Pelosi, as Jake said. You know, the rules right now are, well, she set them up. They're not really stacked in her favor on this. And she could have a real showdown with John Dingell, and this is bad for Democrats.
Jack, we're going to have a lot more ethanol being produced in this country, but not higher taxes on the oil companies and subsidies thereby to wind and solar and all the rest. You heard Senator Vitter there, who wanted more emphasis on domestic oil production. But environmentalists, by no means fully satisfied with this as our answer to the challenge of the century.
No, they're not. And you mentioned the energy companies. There was going to be a $28 billion fund for research into renewables paid for by ending tax breaks to oil and gas and coal producers. And that was voted down. It passed, of course, by a majority, but the Republicans filibustered it. So it couldn't get to be part of the bill. And another element that was defeated, a very important one, was the requirement that coal companies make 15% of their effluent be from clean sources, and that was defeated too, again, and this time by senators from the South and representatives from the coal states.
So energy companies then, power production companies, will not be required then to into wind and solar and all the rest of that. Much more to say on energy, but I want to look at the political side of the map here as well. Mayor Michael Bloomberg announcing this week he's leaving the GOP, says he doesn't have bigger ambitions for now. Let's listen.
My intention is to be mayor for the next 925 days and probably about 10 hours. whatever's left, 11 hours, and that is my intention. I've got the greatest job in the world, and I'm going to keep doing it.
Jake Tapper, he's got the greatest job in the world, but you and a lot of others have been watching the byplay here. What do you see in Mayor Bloomberg's out of the GOP dance this week?
Well, I think it was very clearly orchestrated. He had just come off a tour of the country where he had been talking about how the two-party system, partisan politics, were failing America. Washington, D.C. was sinking into a swamp of dysfunction. Mm-hmm. He attended a conference in Los Angeles where he basically got an endorsement from Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, although at the time Bloomberg was a Republican, so yeah. Who knows, maybe Schwarzenegger would renounce it. I think it's very clear that he's very seriously considering a bid, and people close to him say that that's true. And this dance, this whole coy, I have no intention of running, and my plan is to stay as mayor, and I am not a candidate. It's getting a little tiresome for me, just as a political reporter, to cover this coy language. We're all smart and sophisticated enough to understand what's really going on. I don't know why, and it's annoying, especially when somebody like Bloomberg, who says he's not a politician. I'm not a politician. He always says it. This is about as standard a political shtick as you can get. This whole, I mean, Barack Obama was not running for president until he was running for president. So I don't think anybody's fooled by it.
E.J. Kessler, Eve, you're right there in New York. What about this dance of the one veil again and again? How are New Yorkers interpreting it?
Well, the word on the political street in New York is you just got to get your mind around the idea that Michael Bloomberg has one B that he can put to the project. And
one B as in billion.
That's correct. And he's perfectly willing to spend it. He has a coterie of folks around him who have nothing better to do than to promulgate his campaign in this regard. And so there you have it. I mean, look, the barriers to entry for running for president are very low. Mike Gravel's running for president. Mm. Dennis Kucinich is running for president. Why not Michael Bloomberg?
Why not, when he's got a billion in his back pocket, decent support in New York? Jake, how do you think it will unfold? I mean, this is a guy who didn't make that fortune, you know, as a fool. He knows how to watch the numbers what a context. When, how do you think he'll make a decision here?
Well, that you put your finger on it, Tom, and that is, this is a numbers guy. He made his fortune with the machine. I think there are about 200,000 of them now, called a Bloomberg, that sits on desks, that provides immediate financial information to people. He's a man who just understands. He looks at politics very scientifically, very mathematically. And basically the calculation is the following. It's four-pronged. Next spring, after the Republicans and Democrats have chosen their nominees, if those nominees have disapproval ratings in the 40s or higher,
mm-hmm.
and are perceived as relatively polarizing figures, that's one. If two, 70% or more of the country believes that the nation's on the wrong track, which is currently the case. Three, 20 to 25% of the country has an open mind to a Bloomberg candidacy. And four, 60% of the nation has an open mind to a third-party candidacy. Then those numbers will result in $500 million being spent on Bloomberg for president.
Open the sluice gates, and out comes the Michael Bloomberg bandwagon. Jack, do you see that kind of openness to a third-party candidate, an independent, really working here? Ross Perot tried it, didn't make it, helped Bill Clinton go in. If Bloomberg jumps in the pool, as Jake says, next spring on those numbers, then what?
Then what? I don't see an opening for a third party. I think that the main issue of the election is going to be the war in Iraq, and there is a polarization on that. The Republicans want to continue it. The Democrats all seem to want to stop it. And that doesn't allow for a sort of middle position to say, well, let's deal with this in some harmonious way. And the polls show the public wants a clear choice on it. So I don't see that. But you know, the Bloomberg candidacy is part of an American tradition of anti-partyism that goes way back into the 19th century. And again, Americans say, oh my gosh, the bickering in Washington, the polarization, as if somehow that's just being done by an oligarch within Washington acting for itself. The truth is that the polarization and the bickering reflect real divisions of economic and social interests in society. You know, take the immigration bill. You know, you've got labor on one side, you've got Hispanic rights groups over here, you've got business groups over here, you have nativists over there. You've got border security people. Those are real interests in society that are being represented in the debate. And the public again and again looks at this and they say, we don't like the bickering. Congress's rating now is 23%. Again, we don't like the bickering. But that's the bickering reflects the real clashes of interest in our society. Anti-partyism tries to efface all that and say, let's just do away with all that and get under the hood, as Ross Perot says, and fix up the engine. Right. But boy, you get under that hood, and it's
there's
the
a lot of trouble in there. Yeah. Eve, what do you think there in New York? Is this guy, Bloomberg, bigger than the bickering? Do you see the shoulders on him to muscle through with an independent third-party candidacy?
Well, in New York, we look at Michael Bloomberg as our mayor, and so we have, you know, we see his faults much more clearly than other people do because our press covers.
Sure,
him
everybody
very
sees
closely.
The guy close to home that way.
Right.
Some trouble this week for Giuliani and Hillary Clinton rolling out a theme song and a little video. It's all over YouTube from her campaign to introduce her new theme song. She spoofed the final scene in The Sopranos. Here she's sitting down in a diner, as Tony Soprano did with his clan, but instead with Bill Clinton, flipping or thinking about what they'll have for dinner.
Anything look good?
We have some great choices. I ordered for the table.
No onion rings?
I'm looking out for you.
I guess this is outreach to the great public. They finally come around to the jukebox. He asks what the theme song is going to be. Well, the public voted, we're told, on her website, and chose Canadian superstar Celine Dion's 2004 song, You and I. The song was used in a marketing campaign for Air Canada a few years ago. Here it is, Hillary Clinton's campaign theme song. Okay, expect to hear a lot more of that. Let's hear from our listeners. John in Lowell, Massachusetts. You're on the air, John.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have to tell you that I guess if Americans voted for it, I guess the blame goes to the Americans who voted for it rather than to the Clintons. But I find it really in bad taste. It's a romantic song. It invites people to speak, as far as I see it, to sort of be personally in love in an ecstatic condition with Hillary Clinton. Let me say, I find that hard to imagine myself personally.
But you're looking for a president, not a lover, okay.
That's right. And I think that it demeans our sense of democracy to say that we're not actually governing ourselves. We're falling in love with a symbolic lover.
Yeah, we hear it. Jake Tapper, how about it? You and I were meant to fly, the theme song says. What do you make of the way this became Hillary's theme song? And I mean, does it matter? Is this just nothing at all? Or does it say something about her attitude toward the campaign, the approach of her campaign?
Well, they left it up to people to vote on the internet. So I can't, I mean, like the caller said, you know, I suppose in the same way that we get the leaders we deserve, the electorate gets the leaders they deserve, the Hillary Clinton supporters get the song they deserve that's going to be, you know, jammed down their ears the same way Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow was in 1992.
Right.
Hey, look, it's Celine Dion. I'm not a particular fan of Celine Dion, but then again, I don't know that Hillary Clinton's music or campaign is particularly aimed at you know, 38-year-old males. The weird thing about the Sopranos shtick that they did in introducing the song, which included a cameo from one of the co-stars of the Sopranos, the guy that plays Johnny Sack, is that, and I realize there are people who are going to disagree with me, but it seems from repeated viewings of the final 4 minutes and 33 seconds of the Sopranos, it's very clear to me that Tony Soprano gets whacked. It's very obvious. Yeah. There are enough hints, and I wrote about this on my blog if anybody wants to see what I'm talking about at abcnews.com. But it's very clear that David Chase, the creator of The Sopranos, dropped enough hints to make it very clear, I think, that that's the end of The Sopranos because Tony gets whacked. And I'd like to, you know, Hillary Clinton is playing the Tony Soprano character in this. She's not Carm.
Right.
She's not Carmella.
She's the boss man.
She's the boss man. And so I don't know if this means subconsciously Johnny Sack comes out of the bathroom and whacks Senator Clinton. I don't know, but maybe I'm reading a little too much into
it. Way out in the metaphysics of popular culture right there. Let's get a call from Andrew in Acton, Massachusetts. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
The Bloomberg story is this week's shiny toy in the political sphere, and it distracts us from actual candidates who are really running, and I mean the other mayor, Giuliani. And we had a story out this week that got surprisingly little coverage, considering it goes directly to what his perceived strength is, which is national security.
Mm-hmm.
We learned from Newsday that when he was appointed to the Iraq Study Group, he failed to attend any of their official meetings and was finally given an ultimatum by Baker to either attend or quit, and
right.
he quit.
Yeah.
And the reason was that he had all of these speaking engagements lined up for which he made hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of dollars. And it seems to me that it's significant when a candidate is presenting himself as having strong national security credentials when he essentially blows off an opportunity like this to take part in the most critical national security issue of our time.
Andrew, we hear it. Let us look at it. E.J. Kessler, here we're back in your backyard. Not a great week for Rudy Giuliani. What about the Iraq Study Group piece? He's now sort of retroactively indicating that, well, he didn't much like their work anyway. But what do you make of his no-show status there?
Look, I think the Iraq Study Group's report is fairly irrelevant at this point. I mean, there was a huge splash when it was introduced, but I don't think that President Bush really listened all that much to it.
But haven't we sort of turned back to it in recent months? And in any case, it was serious at the time. Was it not incumbent on him to show up rather than take another speaker's fee?
I think that if you look at the deliberations of the Iraq Study Group, that it was very much a one-man show, and that man was James Baker III. And I don't think that Mayor Giuliani thought he could be all that effective there. I mean, in his defense.
Yeah. Jake, you've been looking at the broader stage that Giuliani's on this week. Some trouble in Iowa, some trouble in South Carolina, two pretty important states.
Yeah, it's like that children's book, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. That's in within a 24-hour period. This story was published by Newsday, which even if one believes the argument just laid out, the mayor's participation on the ISG really would not have mattered that much.
Mm.
It's still not a good story, and it will be used against him by his Republican opponents.
Yep.
Then you have the fact that his chief Iowa consultant, former Congressman Jim Nussel, was tapped to become, by the Bush administration, the new director of the Office of Management and Budget,
right.
taking a very key player out of what will be a very tough caucus for Giuliani, who's not participating in the Iowa straw poll. Will be very difficult for him to win, even though he's still leading in some polls.
Mm.
Then you have the fact that his South Carolina chairman, the state treasurer, Tom Ravenel, was indicted for dealing cocaine.
Not just using or having, but dealing cocaine.
Dealing cocaine, indicted,
oh
which is not convicted, but
yep.
dealing,
yep.
Indicted. And then, of course, you have his political protege of a sort, Mayor Bloomberg, leaving the Republican Party, possibly running for president himself. It just was a horrible 24-hour period for the Giuliani campaign, as they themselves will admit, although they point out that very little, if any, of this was self-inflicted, I guess, with the possibility of the Iraq Study Group story, which I think in the long run is the most important and most damaging story.
Jack, kind of a wacky week in the campaign with Hillary's song, Giuliani's troubles, Brownback, having to reprimand one of his staffers who'd sent out a questionnaire in Iowa about Mormonism, critical, kind of a dig at Romney, who he's had targeted there. Wacky week, Jack.
A wacky week, and just to get back to Giuliani, his position on Iraq is insouciant. He says, well, it could get worse, it could get better, it's not up to me, that'll be up to somebody else. He basically punts on the question of what we should do there or what's happening there. And when he's asked about, the threat, what is the threat, he lumps in Iran with Al-Qaeda, with the Sunnis, and he puts it all in one big gumbo, and he says, well, they're all against the United States. They're all anti-modern. They're all, I mean, in other words, he needed to go to that Iraq study group. He needed to do some Iraq study. The guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And one of the big public relations and unquestioned media shibboleths about him is that he's the guy to deal with terrorism. He knows about terrorism. He doesn't know from nothing about terrorism other than that his city was a victim of it. I mean, he hasn't made any effort, to judge by his public statements, to find out about who the enemy really is.
Well, if he were here, he'd be jumping on your microphone right now, Jack. I can just picture that. Let's take a call from Mount Vernon, Iowa. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment on energy policy. You know, this is about round three or four or five. I'm 50-some years old, so of various energy policies to free us from foreign oil.
Yeah.
And my point is I think we've evolved into kind of a culture of delusion, because there's an equation here, and on one side of the equal sign is that as an American citizen, we don't change our lifestyle much.
Mm.
In other words, having just returned from vacation in Dallas, it seems like we think we've got some sign of a God-given right to eight-lane motoring at 80 mile an hour, and the facts of life are that, you know, there's only so much oil in the earth, and everybody increasingly wants more and more and more of it. So as far as an energy policy that doesn't address some sort of reality check here as far as how we live our lifestyle, I think we're going to find ourselves in more and more hot and nasty places, either controlling or occupying or whatever people that happen to be sitting on the remaining oil reserves in the world.
Not enough for you in this bill. Kevin, thanks for that. Let's get one more call from Charlotte, Vermont. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm also calling about the energy bill, and I'm very disappointed that they weren't able to roll back the tax benefits that were given to the oil companies a couple of years ago. Our economy is based on fossil fuels right now. But we have to get away from that. We have to start thinking about the future and start looking for other energy alternatives. And in order to do that, we need funding. So where should that come from? Well, it's got to come from the ways we produce energy right now. Which
but
is
why not put a tax right on the gas pump if you want more money? Why go to the oil companies, you know, who are going to, I suppose, pass it on anyway,
well,
Mike?
Well, okay, look at it this way. It's costing them X amount of dollars to pump the oil out of the ground. At the same time, the prices of oil are driven by supply and demand. It's a market economy. So even though their costs are relatively constant, the price is going up and as a result of demand, and they are getting windfall profits.
So where's tax to them, going? Take some of those billions and play it forward. Jake Tapper, is this it? Is this all we can get out of our political system, out of Washington, out of the American people when it comes, our caller from Iowa suggests, to sort of lifestyle changes for energy independence or alternative fuels?
Yeah, there are very few Americans who I think when push comes to shove are willing to deal with a 50-cent per gallon tax cut. I'm sorry, tax increase on gas taxes or a ban on SUVs or the serious CAFE standards. Look, the House and the Senate are accountable to voters. And ultimately, it's a cliche, but voters get the elected officials they deserve. And if there was a hue and outcry and a demand for the American people to sacrifice, then politicians would do that. It's the same. I make the same argument when people sometimes fault me or for being part of the TV industry. And certainly there's a lot in television to criticize. But ultimately, we are beholden to ratings, which means we are beholden to viewers.
Yeah.
We are beholden to what people want to watch. Now, I'm not arguing that we should then have a 24-hour Paris Hilton channel. But ultimately, the American people have a lot of power and a lot of control. They're not organized about it, maybe. It's more organic than that. But And that, but that's the truth when it comes to Nielsen ratings or when it comes to politicians. Well, and the American people don't want to sacrifice.
Well, we'll see. We'll pick that up and look at it, Jake. Jack, a lot of talk about the auto industry and the oil industry and the energy production industry blanketing Washington in recent weeks. Exactly to try and damp this down, tamp it down. Jake says it's the people who are going to decide. How do you see it?
The people. Well, it's the interests, too. I think the people are amenable to leadership on this. I think that the response to Al Gore's film, I think, showed that. Now, you can say that was only seen by people who agree with it in the first place. But nevertheless, people who did see it seemed to get just how dire the human prospect is in a globally warming world. The British government report says by 2050, irreversible climate change will begin unless we make drastic changes. Someone has got to stand up and start saying to people, look, we have to change our footprint on this planet if we want to preserve the planet. Yeah. And I think people can understand it. It's just that they've been getting only one side, and the one other than Gore, and the one side really is, oh, your jobs, oh, you're going to be paying 50 cents more, oh, it's, you know, all the costs, but no one's talking about the benefits, which are survival.
Let's go to Kathy.
Those arguments don't win. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I mean, you're talking about the leadership, but the politicians who do that, whether it's Bruce Babbitt or Paul Tsongas, they don't get elected.
Yeah, we hear it. Jake, let me get a call from Kathy in Norwood, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi. My concern is, in the energy bill, is the ethanol. To me, ethanol is, the promotion of ethanol is to buy off farm states. I really question, first of all, using a food product to fuel our gas guzzlers or any automobiles for that matter. It's not forward-thinking. The other thing that really concerns me is, what does that look like to the world? Here we are using a food product when there are people all over the world who need food to survive. And how does that look?
Kathy, our time is short before the break. Let me put it to E.J. Kessler in New York. Kathy says, it's just a big subsidy to the ag states here, all this ethanol push. What do you think, Eve?
I agree. First of all, we have already seen a jump in the price of corn and in the price of food because of that, because not just human beings eat corn, but all kinds of livestock do too. And, I'm not convinced that the economics of ethanol are all that great, frankly.
The economics going down the road in terms of how it's going to work out. They're building an awful lot of plants out there in Illinois and Iowa and all over the place. Jake, they're looking at this as a salvation.
Yeah, they're going to spend a lot of money, and we'll see.
Jake, you can see that the great hopes here for corn princes all over the Midwest.
And you know what they say about John McCain always has this joke about the Senate, which is unless you're under indictment or in rehab, you consider yourself a possible candidate for president.
Lots going on this week. Let's listen for just a moment down to Charleston, South Carolina, where Mayor Joseph Riley mourned the deaths of 9 firefighters this week.
They were in the building to make sure that no one else was in there and to put it out, to protect the neighborhood.
But the roof came down. Astronaut Sunita Williams, who has set the longest record for a woman in space, says she's looking forward to 2 things when she gets home.
Can't wait to get back and feel the air on my face and a sea breeze. I'm looking forward to hopefully going to the beach and taking a walk with my husband and my dog. So that's the first thing. And secondly, I just can't wait for a good piece of pizza.
Words from space, and Walmart announced it's virtually getting into banking.
Walmart is tiptoeing deeper into the financial service sector. It is setting up money centers around the country. It hopes to have about 1,000 by the end of the next year. It's also going to provide consumers with a money card.
Steve's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Oh, good day, Tom.
Hi.
Great show.
Thanks.
All good stuff this week. And Jack, I'm not sure we have so much control in speaking of only getting one side. I think the biggest news story of the week is one which you could say caused all these horrible things, the energy policy, Iraq, Gitmo, and to a certain extent Hillary's theme song, is the secrecy of this administration. And Vice President Cheney, where there's 160,000 emails missing, 51 out of the 88 GOP accounts that have been set up are gone, Rove only has 130 emails in 6 years. I mean, I get that many in a day sometimes.
Yep.
And Gonzalez directed all of this, who everyone seems to have forgotten about.
So look at secrecy, Jack. And, of course, we have Dick Cheney saying he's not part of the executive, so he doesn't need to be covered by all this.
Yeah, when Dick Cheney talks to Congress, he says, I can't give you any information about this. I have executive privilege. But when the National Archives security people come to him and they say, we want to find out about the documents you're using here, as the president charges them to do, he says, I can't cooperate with you because I'm not part of the executive branch. I mean, you can't make this stuff up about Cheney. I mean, this is the man who went on a vacation and shot a friend in the face and then wouldn't talk about it because, quote, it was a private vacation.
but no secret. Eve, what do you make of the secrecy issue here? The vice president, the emails, you know, that are there and the emails that are not there. Are we going to crack through this, or is this just going to be part of the Bush administration until the last day?
Part of the Bush administration until the last day.
Period. End of story. Even with the Democratic Congress, they can't bring down this wall or this this kind of definition of who deserves what secrecy?
George Bush is a stubborn individual, as we have all found out.
with a lot to hide.
Well, Jake, what do you think? Lots of emails out there, lots of incentive in Congress to break through and read them.
But there is, and we should point out that there is, and I'm not talking about the merits of it, but there is a principle here that Dick Cheney, probably more so than George W. Bush, is fighting for, which is Dick Cheney, as the former chief of staff for then-President Ford, saw what he perceived to be an erosion in the power of the executive branch. And since then, it has long been a conservative talking point, a conservative principle, that there needs to be more power in the executive branch and some taken away from the legislative. And so while the caller might be right, and there might, although I don't know that I would blame Dick Cheney for Celine Dion, there might be things that the president and the vice president are hiding, and that might be inappropriate, and Congress maybe should be able to see these emails, et cetera, et cetera. They are fighting for what they perceive to be a principle that has to do with the balance of power.
Maybe it's a principle, but there's a new sort of framework here. The vice president says, I'm not part of the executive, Jake.
Yeah, I don't even understand that at all. And there is very little explanation. We've been talking about this at ABC ever since this argument came. And just like Jack points out, you can't claim executive privilege 1 second and then say you're not part of the executive branch the next. It doesn't make any sense. And if Vice President Cheney would ever do a press conference or talk to anybody other than Tim Russert or Bill O'Reilly, maybe we'd get an answer for it.
Well, he might run down and sit in that big chair in the Senate to make the claim. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I think the big story this week is King George vetoing the stem cell bill because of sanctity of life, but he doesn't care much about the sanctity of life of our soldiers in Iraq.
Yes, we've been there, and we're there again this week. David, thanks for raising that. E.J. Kessler, I guess it's a kind of a no surprise here that the president comes down in the same place. Not ethical to have public funding of this kind of embryonic stem cell research, though it's still legal to do it with other funding.
Right. Well, you know, the president has been very firm on this because he sees it as a question that goes directly to his base. Among evangelicals and conservative Catholics who really object to see federal money spent on this kind of research. And then, you know, you have people in Congress who believe that we need to fund it. So, you know, it's not going to get solved in this administration. Going to wait until the next one.
Yes,
you
know, Jack.
The New York Times pointed out that the cells in question are the size of a period at the end of a sentence. Last week, Hillary Clinton had a stem cell seminar at Dartmouth where doctors and others talked about the issue. And there was a young man there who was about 12 who had 22,000 insulin pricks put into him, these little testers, through his life. He has to take them around the clock. And there was a woman there in her 20s who had run into a moose, which is a hazard on the road up here in New Hampshire, and is going to spend the rest of her life in a wheelchair. Now, here you have the period over here, and you have these people who could benefit from this sort of research by the millions. And it could be any one of us. And the president, for his base politics, as he said, is he's against that.
David,
I don't
in
know
Nashville,
that it's base politics. I'm sorry.
What
to
do you say, Jake?
But,
yes, please.
I just wanted to defend the president for one second, although I don't necessarily hold this opinion. But I mean, he believes that this is human life, and you know that's at least a consistent argument. There's so much inconsistency when it comes to questions about abortion, questions about when life begins. And obviously, we could spend 15 shows talking about all these inconsistencies. But if the president, I think you have to take him on his word, if he thinks that life begins at the moment of conception, then these embryos are human life, and he doesn't think that they should be destroyed in the name of science. And that's his argument. And while you may disagree with it, and you may say that then opens the door to all sorts of questions about then how can he support birth control pills because those destroy fertilized eggs at some point, et cetera, et cetera. I don't disagree, but that's what the president believes, and I think that is a consistent belief.
Our caller from Nashville points us to the Middle East. I want to look at a news story there beyond Iraq. Of course, last week we had Gaza and the West Bank coming apart as Palestinians fought. This week, a lot of action on that front. We had the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert talking with President Bush, saying he wants to support Fatah and the emergency government Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, known as Abu Mazen, has created on the West Bank. Let's listen.
I want to strengthen the moderates and to cooperate with President Abu Mazen, who is president of all Palestinians, perhaps the only person who was widely elected in a democratic manner by all of the Palestinian people. And I am going to make every possible effort to cooperate with him and to look forward to see how things can be worked jointly.
President Bush was right on board, wanting to throw support behind Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and his newly appointed Prime Minister, Salam Fayyad.
Our hope is that President Abbas and the Prime Minister Fayyad, who's a good fella, will be strengthened to the point where they can lead the Palestinians in a different direction with a different hope.
But the news from Gaza, well, a different song there. Here's Mahmoud Zahar, senior Hamas official, dismissing Mahmoud Abbas as a collaborator of the U.S. He said Hamas would build its own government in Gaza.
Fatah is the big loser of this confrontation. We are looking for Fatah, real Fatah, not the collaborator with the Israeli, to run a constructive organization to help the Palestinian issue and to participate in the process of development.
E.J. Kessler, how do you see it? An opportunity for forces of moderation, plus Israel, plus the U.S. here? Or, do we actually at this point hurt Abbas by embracing him?
I see it as throwing good money after bad. I know that sounds a little little right-wing, but that's the way I see it.
Good money after bad, meaning what? It's not worth supporting moderate Palestinians?
It's like, well, they right now they have a bunch of very bad options, and that's probably the least bad of them. And that's what American Israel have decided, and that's what they're going to do. But in the end, I think that we will see that they will have thrown good money after bad. I mean, what the Hamas spokesman said there, that, look, they're the losers. Well, that's exactly right. Fatah and Mohammed Dahlan, their security chief in Gaza,
whose mansion got stripped when things went wild there.
He folded like a house of cards.
After lots of support from the United States.
That's right. He folded like a house of cards. So what are you going to do? I mean, you're going to put more money behind these folks when, you know, they've disappointed you and disappointed you and disappointed you.
What's the alternative? Everybody says we need some.
There is no alternative.
Well,
you've got to know what you're doing.
Yeah. Jake Tapper, how about it? I'm looking here at The Economist magazine coming out next week. They say they're worried that the Western policy of showering money and arms on corrupt secular movements like Fatah is in danger of strengthening the Islamists. What do you think, looking on from back here, Jake?
I think it's true. Except that the only alternative to that is to disengage, and then those Islamists actually win elections. As we were talking before about, you know, what the American electorate wants, what's the great fear in Pakistan? That the dictator, General Musharraf, has you know, that he would be replaced in a free and fair election by somebody much more hostile to the United States. Same thing in Saudi Arabia, same thing in Egypt, same thing in Jordan, same thing in the Palestinian territory. So however much we may loathe dealing with corrupt secular Arab nations or leaders, I should say, the alternative is potentially Al-Qaeda with a nuclear weapon. And so, I mean, it may be good money after bad. It may be a horrible situation, but the alternative is worse.
Jack, in Iraq this week, that full surge of U.S. troops now on hand and deployed, chasing down Al-Qaeda, we're told, though in some locations like Baquba, I saw a Los Angeles Times report saying the streets, when the U.S. soldiers showed up, nearly empty. Insurgents had stashed their weapons and, you know, taken off, the old kind of insurgent two-step here. What are you seeing in the height of the surge and the forward outlook there, Jack?
Well, we've had 14 soldiers killed in the last 48 hours, and the papers have been full this week of the impasse and the split in the Iraqi government. The Sunni vice president doesn't talk to the Shiite president, and that's our exit strategy, their political solution. They're no closer to it. And on we grind, and even when you start to look at the details of this tragedy, it just for example, the explosive devices, it was known several years ago that these V-shaped hulled vehicles could offset them. And you know why those weren't built in any rapid way? Inter-service rivalry. The Marine Corps had some objections to something the Army wanted to do, and we didn't have a Secretary of Defense who could come in and say, listen, these are lives at stake. We don't care about your inter... We want to get those vehicles built now, and they're only coming into line now. And, you know, that just shows the callousness that our caller David was mentioning about how we have handled despite the piety about our fighting forces and our troops, the callousness with which they've been protected and with which, when they return, they're ignored. As we heard in the Washington Post this week, the psychological counseling for the soldiers, a fourth of whom may have severe problems in that regard, is practically nil.
Everybody might wonder though if there's a vehicle big enough to save this operation. Let's get one more call from Kathy in Newton, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi. All of the topics that you've covered, I think, lead to one question. We need an extremely charismatic next president in order to move the country. Right now, everybody is sitting on their partisan podiums preaching to their base, and the country's basically stalemated. And I think it's either going to take a very charismatic president or a very bad nuclear terrorist attack to change people's position.
Do you see anyone out there charismatic enough to move the country off the dime, Kathy?
Yeah.
Who?
Yeah. And what, I don't know. Who do your commentators think would be useful? I mean, much as I would like to see a Democratic president, I don't know.
Sounds like you'll take anybody who can move the country sort of out of where it sits right now. Well, I don't know. Jack Bloomberg's at the one in the news this week. He's not charismatic. Do you see him as a population mover, as a policy mover? If he decided to throw his hat in,
I mean, he's got the money to make that to make his views well known. No, I don't see him as somebody who can rally us. And the fact is, we are a 50-50 nation. And even though President Bush now in the latest Newsweek poll is at 26%, nevertheless, many of the policies that he has espoused are still popular among many Americans. So a charismatic candidate who tries to say, here's what we've got to do, and shows no shade of no nuance, it risks immediately getting, you know, half the voters against him. So it's or her. So I'm very distrustful of charisma. I would far rather have evidence and persuasion. And I think we need need more of that. You know what made Ross Perot so successful as a candidate? He had charts. He educated people. You saw the stuff, and people learned. Americans can learn.
But the president's name was Clinton when he got done with that.
Well, that's true. That's true. But by gosh, he was very successful in for a long time just in getting himself 19% third party.
Yeah, that will make him president. Jake, in a word, we just got a few seconds. Do you think charisma is going to be the big key?
I think if it's so tough to do in one word. Yeah. Hillary Clinton is pursuing the candidacy of trying to win all the states John Kerry won and one more.
Yep.
That is not what the caller is talking about. The caller is talking about somebody who will unite the country. Barack Obama thinks he's the man, and Rudy Giuliani on the Republican side. But other than that, I don't see anyone running that kind of campaign.
We got strategies and a theme song, but maybe not the charisma piece. Jake Tapper, E.J. Kessler, and Jack Beatty, thanks to each of you for being with us. Callers, thanks for being here, too. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.